Good morning. I am Pastor Alex. I'm not Pastor Mark, and I'm not Pastor Matt. Pastor Mark is away with family this weekend. Pastor Matt is preaching at Barrakel at a youth retreat, and so you have me this Sunday, which is good. Not third string, as Pastor Mark preached on a couple weeks ago, but just the next man up, if you will. So a couple weeks ago, Pastor Mark's been in a series on 1 Corinthians for several weeks now, going back to the first of the year. And a couple weeks ago, we saw this date on the calendar, and we're like, Alex, would you be interested in preaching? And I was like, sure. And then he was kind enough to push me in a direction, if you will, gently nudge me. He said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could do kind of a contextual sermon going back to the story in Acts when Paul goes to Corinth? He's writing this letter in 1 Corinthians back to the church. But there, you know, is a starting point in the story when he actually goes himself and spends a year and a half in Corinth. And so wouldn't that be cool to kind of see the story as it's laid out in Acts, kind of engage with some of the characters that we're presented with, some of the characters that reappear in the letter itself in 1 Corinthians. And so he said, did you do this? And I said, sure, this would be good. And so we're going to be spending this sermon today in Acts chapter 18. We're going to jump around to a couple other passages, but Acts 18 will be the primary passage. We're going to read through that here in a second, but I do want to kind of give some context. The title of the sermon today, God Continues Building His Church. God is the one building His church, not man, not some other power, but it's God is the one who's actively involved and actively using people and building His church. And so we'll dive in there. First off, and I apologize, the PowerPoint will be utilized a little differently than Pastor Mark does it. There is a lot of words on some of these slides, and for that I apologize. It's how it is. So we're just going to kind of plow through. It helps if you focus, your eyes will adjust. So pick me as a focal point, or pick that as a focal point, but I discourage you going back and forth, but it's okay. First off, a historical timeline. There are some preconceived notions and sometimes mistakes that are made when we look at the city of Corinth. Commentators have made these mistakes, preachers have made these mistakes, and one of the big assumptions that is made is we know right where Corinth is. We know Corinth is it's on the southern portion of Greece. We know that's the location, and so we default by saying, well, Corinth is a Greek city. It's a Greek city with Greek people, with Greek culture, and pastors and preachers and commentators, some of them have kind of defaulted, and they kind of like, well, we need to understand Greek society in order to understand Corinth. Well, in this particular time and place, that's not really true, because we know in 146 BC, the Greek city of Corinth rebelled against the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire does what it did best. They come in with wrath and fury, and they destroy Corinth. Corinth is wiped off the face of the map. We know they did similar things in Jerusalem. They know they did similar things in other cities, in Carthage. Corinth was just obliterated. No more Corinth in 146 BC. Greek city, no longer it. 100 years later, in 44 BC, we know that Corinth was restored and replanted by Julius Caesar. Everybody knows Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar replants it, makes it a Roman colony. It becomes 100% through and through Roman. It's a Roman culture, Roman city, Roman hub, and from then on, we know it in this particular context as a Roman city. Some other details that we're going to highlight before we jump into the story, we know historically that in AD 49, so 100 years after the church is replanted, we know that Emperor Claudius declares an edict, which expels all the Jews and by default some of the Christians from Rome. We know that the Jews have disagreements over who Jesus is. And those disagreements boil over into uprisings, and they boil over into hostilities, which we'll read about as Jews engage with Paul. We know that Suetonius, a Roman historian, said that since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the incites of Crestus, reference to Christ, Greek, Latin word for Christ, Crestus, so he expelled them from Rome. That's an ironic statement, and we'll talk about that later. The Jews who can't stand Jesus are expelled from Rome and are forced into exile because of the man that they despise. We know that in AD 51 or AD 52, Gallio, who we'll see in Acts 18, was appointed proconsul. He was appointed governor of Achaia, the province, by Claudius, the emperor. And Corinth was the capital of Achaia. So we know he was appointed. It wasn't. It's not just a name. It's a real person in real history that's appointed, AD 51, AD 52, somewhere in there. We know that in AD 51, every other year, we know that Corinth is hosting these Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games, they're kind of like the world championships of sports. They're not the Olympics. They're second tier to the Olympics, but these would be right up there, held in the off year, if you will, between the Olympic Games. And so we know that these were hosted in Corinth. We know that this was right about the time that Paul was in Corinth. And so we know not only was Corinth a city of 200,000 people strong, we know that there are these games that are drawing people in from all over the Mediterranean to witness and watch these games. So we know there's a big hub, there's a big to-do going on in Corinth. We know that in AD 54-55, we know that Paul writes 1 Corinthians. So we know that by the time he's writing this, he's already been to Corinth, he's spent a year and a half there, he's traveled on, and now he's writing a letter going back. And in that same time frame, we know that Gallio abdicated his governorship, the character we talked about. He comes in, he serves a short stint as governor, illness strikes him, and then he, due to poor health, has to abdicate his governorship and give that up and move on. So we know that to be the case. Bear with this slide. I'll try to explain it here. Map of the Roman Empire, kind of as Paul would have known it in his second missionary journey. We know Paul in Acts 18 is in the midst of his second missionary journey. And I want to draw your attention to some of the arrows. And I apologize for those that some are harder to see than others. But on the right top right-hand side of your screen, you have a yellow arrow. We know that that was Pontius, Turkey. That's going to be important because we know Aquila was from Pontius, Turkey, who bounced then to Rome, kind of indicated by the other yellow arrow, north of there, and then was in Corinth, where all these characters kind of converge, which is the red arrow there kind of in the middle of your screen. So we know Pontius, Turkey, moved from there, moved to Rome, then to Corinth. We know in the navy arrow, kind of in the middle of your screen on the right-hand side, we know that Saul, now Paul, was from Tarshish, southern Turkey. And we know he kind of bounced around in and around Damascus, kind of probably made his way down to Jerusalem and back and forth, was converted, and then is preaching all around the Mediterranean, once again planting a church in Corinth. Red arrow. Green arrow on the bottom of your screen, we know that to be Alexandria, Egypt, which we'll hear about in a little bit. Apollos, who we'll meet, is from there. And so all these people kind of scattered around the Mediterranean, they all converge in Corinth, this young, kind of new, now thriving center, this metropolis in the Greco-Roman Empire. And they converge, and they're all helping build the church. And so that's kind of the context we're going to see as we go through here. So we're going to do, as we move forward, we're going to look at Paul's ministry. And then we're going to do kind of three character sketches. We're going to look at Priscilla and Aquila, the husband and wife. We're going to look at Gallio, the secular pagan governor of Corinth, and then we're going to look at Apollos, the preacher who kind of moves in and comes into Corinth after the fact. So let's look to the text, and we're going to bear with this. We're going to read it. We're going to plow through this text here and really, you know, pay attention to the names, the places. This is the information that's given. There was a kind of a little bit of like some red flags that went up in my mind where you're like, well, could you preach on Acts 18? Well, there's not some big theological point that Paul's trying to make here. Timothy, you know, Luke's doing the writing here. So what do we, you have to look to the context, we have to look to the characters that are presented, and we're going to try to find some application for us in real life. We're going to look back, and we're going to see what exactly, you know, God would have for us. So in Acts chapter 18, verse 1, it says, after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. So we know that he's coming from Athens. If you look back in your previous paragraph, he's engaging with the, you know, kind of pagan philosophers who worship all these different gods, and now he's traveling from Athens. He spent a little bit of time there, and now he's coming to Corinth. So he left Athens, went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them. And because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people." And he stayed there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. Verse 12, but when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, "This man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of these things." And he drove them from the tribunal. And they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. And jump down to verse 24. We see that Paul then stays a little longer. He moves on, goes to Antioch, and preaches there, and then ends up down in Ephesus eventually. But in verse 24, now a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, competent in the scriptures. He'd been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he wished to cross to Achaia, so he's looking to leave Ephesus and go over to Achaia, which is Corinth, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. When he arrived, he greatly helped those who through grace had believed. For he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, showing by the scriptures that the Christ was Jesus. Before we dive in and we start to look to Aquila and Priscilla, I want us to take a step back here and I want us to kind of think about our own personal lives. We're all here gathered together Sunday morning, you know, end of February 2016 at 5433 North Center Road at Emmanuel Bible Church. And I kind of want to look at that. We have the saying and kind of in our culture and our, you know, in our, we've heard it before, hindsight is 2020. What brings us to this place in this time, here gathered together with the people, the family members that we may or may not be sitting with, in the job that I left during the week, and I'm kind of getting a reprieve from that on the weekend? What's brought me to Saginaw, Michigan, if I've been bounced around all these different places? What has me here? And I would encourage us, when we look back, when we try to see God working in our lives, sometimes it's very difficult to see it in the context of the present. But when I take a look back and I say, well, this is where I've been, and this is, you know, I met my wife here, I had my job, I was hired here, I was fired here and rehired at another position, I moved from this town to another town, and now I live in this house, in this place. And we'd be like, yeah, God was piecing that together. But we sometimes have a hard time seeing that in the present. So thus our saying, hindsight is 20/20. We can always put it together afterwards. As Christians, we have the gift not only being able to look back in our own lives, but we have the gift of being able to look to the story of the Bible and the characters that are presented to us, and we can see the lives and God's interactions with those lives as he kind of moved in time and space and used people to kind of lay out his plan. And so as we're looking at these characters, I encourage us to look at our own lives, try to see where God is working, because ultimately the application will tie back into what do we do today with where we're at here at Emmanuel in Saginaw doing whatever God may have us to do. But we look and we see first off Aquila and Priscilla. Aquila, as we've noted, was a native of Pontus in northern Turkey. And for reasons unknown, the Bible doesn't say, he moves from Pontus in northern Turkey. He gets up, moves about 1,000 miles to Rome. They find themselves in Corinth as a result of being expelled from Rome by the edict of the emperor. The emperor says, we've had it with the Jews, not going to deal with it anymore. get out of town. Some of the Jews, some of the Christians, they're picked up and they're transplanted elsewhere. And for some reason, they end up in Corinth. They could have went anywhere, but they moved to Corinth. Corinth is a hub. The games are going on. We know they're businessmen. Priscilla and Aquila, probably well-to-do. They're tent makers by trade, so they're not preachers. They're just lay people. We would call them. But they're doing their work, and they know there's business to be done. They probably end up in Corinth for some reason along those lines. But like Paul, like we said, they're tent makers. This allows them to work together with Paul, common bond. This relation, and their relationship kind of develops with each other. We know that Corinth was a bustling city. We know that there were a lot of people there. And we know there were a lot of Jews there. But Paul ends up living with these people. Now we can say, well, they were both tent makers. It just makes sense. You know, when you move into a town, one's coming from one direction, one's coming from the other direction. It's just not a foregone conclusion you're going to cross paths. But they did. I like what John Calvin said in his commentary on Acts. He says, though the commodiousness of the city was such, so busy, the plenty was so great, the situation so pleasant, money was being exchanged, the people in Corinth were most likely prosperous people in general, and there were also so many Jews there, so they weren't the only ones, yet Paul found no more fit host than a man that had been banished out of his own country and also out of another soil. We hear Priscilla and Aquila, and it's kind of said in that order usually when they appear, but they appear several times in the scriptures, and we're reminded that they were known for their hospitality. Whether they were in Rome, we know that when they went back to Rome, they opened up their home there and the church was meeting there. We know that they're, you know, obviously opening themselves up to Paul in Corinth. In Ephesus, the same thing is happening when they kind of bounce around. These people are known for their hospitality. And if we're going to discount that, these people who have been kicked around the Mediterranean for various reasons, they come into Corinth, they're known for opening up to Paul, we can look at them and we can be like, what were they doing? If anybody could have taken a step back and probably said, you know what, no, I'm going to lay low for a little bit, I know my spiritual gift is hospitality, but you know what, I've just made this long move, I'm going to kind of take a step back and just, you know, take some time for myself. And the church would have looked at them and been like, oh, that's fine. But for some reason, in spite of their circumstances, in spite of where they've been, in their context, and we know that it was a grueling progression of events because you don't just get exiled every day. The government just doesn't come to tell you and just move. And they got to pick up and leave. But we know that in spite of their circumstances, they're like, nope, we're going to serve God and we're going to be godly people in all circumstances. And that's where we find ourselves here with Priscilla and Aquila. Given their situation, given all that's gone on, given even the situation in Corinth, Paul, for some reason, finds themselves in relationship with Priscilla and Aquila. And we can tell ourselves, as we look to this story and we look to some of the other stories here, we can tell ourselves that it was chance that moved them from Pontus to Rome. It was chance that caused the governor or caused the emperor to make an edict to cast them out, and it was chance that they end up in Corinth, and it was chance that they cross paths with Paul. That's all chance, or we have a bigger picture, and that's where we'll look at it when we conclude today, that God has a plan, and he is working out that plan with these people as they move from place to place. Aquila and Priscilla, ministry practice. We see here in Paul kind of has his go-to moves, if you will, when he comes into a town. This isn't unique. When he comes into town, where are the he finds the synagogue. He knows there are Jews that need to be preached to. So he goes, and we see Paul. He's a tent maker, and he spends his Sabbath in the synagogue, reasoning and persuading with the Jews and the Greeks. The Greek words there for reasoning, persuading, we get the impression that it was a slow, methodical trying to make the case for Christ, if you will. We're going to look to the Old Testament, which is something the Jews would be happy to talk about, they'd be happy to engage with, and we're going to look at, here are the characteristics of the Messiah, something the Jews at that time would have been like, they've been looking forward to the coming of the Messiah. So he's kind of making the slow, methodical case, having conversations in regards to the characteristics of the Messiah that would be well understood, given their understanding of the Scriptures. However, where he runs into trouble and where the Jews really get hostile and they start to, you know, rabble-rouse, if you will. When Jesus gets a name, he persists in this for a while with the practice of persuading, looking to the Old Testament, most likely. But when he begins to preach Jesus by name, he's preaching the simplicity of his message, and I love that, where Jesus, or the Messiah, is the Christ, or Jesus is the Christ. Simplicity of message, but when he gives the Christ a name, that's when he begins to face opposition. They begin to oppose, they begin to revile him when the name of Jesus is proclaimed as the Messiah. And I think we've all, experienced that. And people are willing to engage in light conversations about God. You know, God's good. You know, God is a good God. He's a loving God. And people, you know, want to talk about. People are willing probably to talk about God generally. But when we speak of Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life, and he is the Messiah, and you know, he's the way that we come into right relationship with God by belief in him, that's when the walls start to go up. And so the reaction here, Paul's frustration, if you will, we see in verse 6, when the reviling and the opposition starts, we see the practical, real-life look at what Matthew 5, 11, and 12 is telling us. Matthew 5, 11, and 12 says, "In the Beatitudes, blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the saints who were before you." So the treatment that Paul is getting is treatment that we can say like, oh, that's really bad. That was, you know, bad for Paul, bad for that situation. No. That's to be expected. When we preach the gospel and we preach Jesus, we know that hostility will come. We know that people, not everybody's going to buy into that, and not everyone's going to lovingly receive that message. And this is what's happening to Paul. He's being persecuted for preaching Jesus to the Jews. And in Matthew 10:5, Jesus, we see the practical application here later on in the passage with the response that Paul has to this treatment. So they oppose, they revile him, and Paul does something that's fairly dramatic. He, you know, takes most likely his clothes off, shakes them out, and puts them back on and says, "I'm done with this. I'm done preaching to you. You've had your chance. I'm now moving on, and I'm going to preach to the Gentiles." Kind of throwing up his hand saying, "I'm done." Now, we say that. Now, that's kind of rash. It's really dramatic. But ultimately, Jesus encouraged his disciples when he sent them out preaching in the various towns in Matthew 10. The response was biblical. Jesus told his disciples, as you go from place to place and as you go to different houses, when you go up and you preach the good news, and some people are going to accept that. Some people are going to say, no, I don't want anything to do with that. That's fine. If they get hostile, they get pushy, that's fine. Dust your feet off and just go to the next house. Say, I'm moving on. I'm taking my message elsewhere. So we can look at his response and be like, well, that's really dramatic. He's, you know, it's an overreaction. No, he's probably engaging in a biblical practice, something that was, you know, engaged in with other preachers. It's interesting, or it's ironic, if you will, that he's so frustrated, he's so dramatic with his response to this opposition, his frustration is so great, if you will, that it carries him all the way next door. He doesn't leave town, he doesn't go across, you know, he ends up just next door. He sets up at the house of Titus Justus, who we meet in the passage, as a Gentile who just happens to live in close proximity to the synagogue. It's noted for us that now we have Paul, who's given up his ministry, his preaching to the Gentiles, or to the Jews, and it's noted that Crispus is the first convert. Crispus is a Jew, and his whole family. He's the head of the synagogue. His whole family is the one that's converted. Paul, constantly, he has this tension throughout his ministry, and you see it come up in different letters that he writes, where, you know, he is called, we know that, to preach the word to the Gentiles. But he has in his heart, he has an affinity for his people. He is Jewish. He's a converted Jew. He wants to see his people converted and come to Christ. And there's always that tension of, I'm called to preach to the Gentiles. I want, with all that's in me, to see my people saved and to see them believe. And so you see this kind of this tension even playing itself out where, yeah, I'm frustrated, but I'm not going to go terribly far away from you because in passing on your way to the synagogue, surely some of us are going to engage and I'm going to see people come to faith, hopefully, in the form of Crispus. Now, we don't know where exactly his heart was at this point. We do know what's coming next in the story, and that's an encouraging word from God. We don't know if in his frustration. He is resolved at this point to just move on, leave Corinth, move out. We know that Paul only spends a couple months, maybe 6 months, sometimes less than that, sometimes just weeks in certain locations. He does not really, you know, he's definitely a traveling preacher. He does not usually plant roots. So we don't know really where his heart is at this point. We can speculate, but we do know that God offers him a word of encouragement in 9 and 10. The Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid." Now, whether he was already afraid or God was saying, you know, things are coming, don't be afraid, we can speculate on that. But the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you." Which is very interesting because what comes in verse 11, "For I have many who are my people in this city." Two things to note there. We know the promise is not that, don't worry, no one's going to attack you, but rather that no harm will come to you even if people attack you. No harm will come to you by way of attack. In verse 11, if Paul was not hearing that properly, he'd be like, "What were you talking about, God? Because you just, I'm getting hauled off by these angry Jews. I'm getting hauled before the Roman governor," which we'll talk about. What's going on there? So notice that, you know, it's interesting. You know, he's not saying that no harm will come or no attack will come, but rather no harm through those attacks. Also, the confidence that Paul is given, that God knows that there are many people who are going to believe because of the work that Paul is doing. Paul may not see that in the everyday preaching. You know, he sees the frustration, he sees the opposition, he sees the reviling, and to the point where I'm getting frustrated, I want to move on. You know, he's, you know, telling somebody, the blood is on your own head. Have we really ever thought about telling that to somebody who just doesn't want to believe? Sorry, I've shared the gospel with you. Blood's on your own head. I'm moving on. I'm innocent now. God preached the truth to you. I know I've never done that to anybody, and I'd be guessing that the hands would be limited if you're like, yeah, I really engaged with somebody on that level. So there's confidence, though, that don't worry, keep preaching, be bold. No harm is going to come to you. We have people, I have people in this city that are going to believe. Encouraging words that we can kind of apply even in our own personal context, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. In walks Gallio. Gallio is a Roman pagan. We just have his name, which is interesting. If you do a little, you know, research, a little research online, you can get a little context for who Gallio was as a person. He's the Roman, we know from this text that he's the Roman proconsul. He's the governor who's appointed as Paul would have been beginning his ministry. So those are really, those timelines are running parallel to each other. He comes in, starts preaching. Gallio either has just been appointed or he's just appointed after the preaching starts. So they're running, timelines are very in sync with each other as it pertains to Corinth. History tells the story, and I say the unlikely crossing of paths that takes place between himself, Gallio, and Paul. Gallio is from a very prominent Roman family. If you've studied rhetoric in college, if you've studied philosophy in college, or personally in your own time, you would come across the name Seneca. Seneca was a famous, the older, Seneca, the dad to Gallio, was a famous rhetorician. Very prominent, did a lot of writing in Roman society, Roman culture. People looked to him when it came to the ideas of rhetoric. His brother, Seneca the Younger, famous philosopher. You may read in, you know, some textbooks, Seneca appears as a writer of Roman philosophy. Very bright guys. Very prominent Roman family. There's some sort of an issue that plays itself out, and history tells us that Seneca had a thing for Claudius, who's the emperor, his wife. There's some sort of extramarital thing going on, rubs Claudius the wrong way. Seneca, and most likely, history tells us, it's not 100%, but most likely Gallio, as the brother, gets shipped off to Corsica. They get exiled for a period of 8 years. Corsica is familiar to us because that's where Napoleon in history was exiled to, little remote island in the middle of the Mediterranean. So they're exiled for a period of 8 years. Claudius, as many Roman emperors did, found his taste with that current wife, passes over her, and remarries, and they have a baby Nero, who we know as Christians are proud of Nero, all the persecution he rendered. They have a baby, baby's Nero. The wife knows they have some bright people that are in exile that we need to have tutor baby Nero. So they go bring him back, and Seneca is engaged with the baby, and he's teaching and passing wisdom on, tutoring Gallio, similar capacity. In the meantime, Gallio gets appointed proconsul of Achaia for an extremely short period of time. Due to illness, his reign, his service to the emperor was 2 to 3 years max, and he passes on. So you have this guy who's prominent Roman family, has some issues that arise between his family and the emperor, somehow ends up in Corinth as the governor there. An unlikely crossing of paths is what I say. And not only is it unlikely, it's unlikely in the sense that, wow, the timeline just overlapped just perfectly. And we can go back and we can play the chance game with this story, or we can say, like, wow, God was really using a secular pagan when it came to Gallio and building his church in Corinth and using Paul. R.C. Sproul, famous author, preacher today, in his commentary on Acts said, when the prophecy from Paul's vision seemed to fail, so God gives him a word of encouragement, God says, you know what? No harm's going to come to you by way of attack. Well, attack immediately comes. Probably, most likely, if he's a normal human, Paul's like, what's going on here? But along came the Roman proconsul, a tool in the hand of God who protected Paul and allowed the preaching of the gospel to go on and the church at Corinth to flourish. I think it's interesting that Paul is dragged in by the Jews, and Paul, who's not uncomfortable speaking, is about ready to speak, the text says. He's about ready to make his defense, why he should be let go or whatever. He claims his Roman citizenship in other places. And later in the story, he may be willing to do that now, which would immediately give him audience with the emperor. But before he's ready to speak, Gallio interjects and says, this matter doesn't interest me. Very similar to like what Pontius Pilate, his initial reaction when Jesus was brought before him, this isn't my business, it's your business, take it elsewhere, deal with solve your own matters later. So before Paul can defend himself, before Paul can pull the emergency switch, if you will, to possibly go before the Roman emperor and claim his citizenship, Gallio steps in, frees him. And then we're reminded, we're not going to really talk about him here, but poor Sosthenes, who's mentioned as a brother to Paul in 1 Corinthians, verses 1 and 2, Sosthenes is mentioned. He's the innocent, he's the bystander here. Nobody really knows why, but Paul is free to go. They go grab this guy and they beat him in the presence of Gallio, and Gallio just doesn't really take notice of it. Very interesting. Is it chance, or is God doing something even with a secular pagan in the form of Gallio? And we'll talk about that in a minute. Verse 24, we meet Apollos. If we go back to that map, we know that Apollos was a Hellenistic Jew from Alexandria. He's from Egypt. Somewhere along the way, he's converted to Jesus and now is preaching the gospel in Ephesus. We know that his gospel's incomplete, really. We know that he's preaching truth about Jesus, but we know he knows nothing of the Holy Spirit. That's not on his radar yet. So his message is good, it's truth, but it's incomplete. Aquila and Priscilla, they come up to him, they find him, they see that he's doing a good work, and they kind of fill in the gaps, if you will. They bring him up to speed on the Holy Spirit, and they know that he has a desire to go into Achaia, and they're going to pursue him going that direction. Before we get to the application of 1 Corinthians 3, 5, and 9, I do want to give a little bit of a tidbit. If you know anything, historians tell us that Corinthian culture was such that you had when people would come in and they'd have something to say, Corinthians wouldn't necessarily pay attention to what was being said. I think the saying went like the truth was of just secondary importance to them. They cared more about the personality delivering the message. If the guy looked good, that's good. I'll pay attention to what he has to say. Well, what did he say? I don't really know. He just looked good. We know Paul, when he leaves, and we get that kind of in the gap section here of verses 18 to 22, we know that Paul cuts his hair off, because he's most likely taken upon himself a Nazarite vow. So on the way out of Corinth, we know that Paul probably looks like a hobo. Got the long hair, got the big beard, probably not the most attractive creature in the world. Now, not a lot is told to us about Apollos, But we know that he speaks well. He's very eloquent. He delivers, you know, and so you have this kind of contrasting of styles, if you will, which it makes sense then when he comes into Corinth preaching the same message that Paul did, that maybe divisions would start to come up. The divisions that Paul is writing about, well, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, well, I follow Jesus, well, I follow such and such. It makes sense that if they're attaching themselves to the person and not the message, it makes sense that they would be like, yeah, I'm going to flock to you, Apollos, because you look good. You're saying the same thing. I don't want to tell myself that, but you look good and you're my guy. And we play similar games here, you know, in our modern day. It's not all that different. You know, we like the message holder, the message bearer, if you will, to, you know, kind of look respectful. And look, he has a certain way about him or a certain way with words, and we'll attach ourselves to certain personalities, as Pastor Mark's referenced in previous messages. But you see with that context what 1 Corinthians 3, 5 through 9 says. So in verse 4, actually, for when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not being merely human? Verse 5, what then is Apollos? What then is Paul? Servants through whom you believed as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one. They're not different. They're the same. And each will receive his wages according to his labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. And the reminder there is ultimately, you know, we don't have a stake to claim of our own that says, my message, it's mine. It's not, you know, it's mine and mine alone. No, it's God's message. And we have the luxury of being a part of that story, that whenever we get to preach it, whenever we get to share the gospel. So God gave the growth. Ultimately, what Paul started by planting his church and planting the church in Corinth was built upon by Apollos. In the same way, Paul was able to expand upon the work that was begun by Apollos in Ephesus. And I mentioned this in the first service, and I'll mention it again here. The Ephesian people didn't have the same problem that the Corinthians evidently had, because none of this division, this rivalry, comes up in the letter that Paul's writing back to the Ephesians, or at least it wasn't a prominent issue. But if you had an addendum, if you will, you can add Ephesians chapter whatever at the end of the book, you would know, it could be said that, well, Apollos planted, and Paul came in and watered, and God grew the church. So in the same way that Paul planted in Corinth, Apollos watered, he came in on his coattails, in the same way Paul could have done, the same thing played itself out in reverse order in Ephesus. Cool story, a lot of cool people, a lot of interesting characters, some interesting facts, little tidbits, but ultimately, what's the point? Why is this important? And for that, I want to turn to Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. Big picture, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded. For I'm doing a work in your days, and I should say, that you would not believe if told. Ultimately, in the context of Habakkuk is complaining to God, you're letting evil triumph. There's evil kingdoms that are doing horrible things. How long are you going to let them reign? And how long are you going to sit there and do nothing? God replies, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. And ultimately, we know that work that God is doing is the bringing of his son, the saving of his church, the building of his church, and the spreading of the gospel around the world. And we know that's the big work. And ultimately, I'm willing to speculate here that God, if he had went to Apollos when he was in Egypt, prior to conversion in Alexandria, similar if you would have went to Aquila when they're living in northern Turkey, not necessarily Christians at the time, and even Saul, if you would have went to Saul when he was in Tarshish, a Pharisaical terrorist seeking out people, Christians, who he can arrest and or kill, If he would have said, you know what, I have a plan, I'm building my church through you guys, and came to you ahead of time and said, you know what, all of you guys are going to converge in Corinth and be part of the work of growing my church and spreading the fame of Jesus, it may have been laughable, if not offensive to people like Paul or Saul at the time. Definitely unbelievable. But even today, God is actively building his church in the same manner that he did in Corinth. We know that God is constant. We know that his ways are consistent. And we know that his church is being built in the exact same way. And we can look to that story and we can say, yes, I see it there and I see it. And now we can kind of, you know, try to see here what God is doing in the present. What does it mean for me? Big picture, God is doing something big. He's doing something grand. His gospel is awesome and it's going forth. What does it mean for me and you? It means that we should never discount or take for granted those relationships that God has made us a part of. Going back to the introspection, if you will, that I had you do kind of earlier in the message. You look to the people you're with today. You look to the jobs you work right now. You look to whatever, sir, you know, what's brought you here. Is that merely chance that has brought us together, or is that God doing something big and doing something wonderful? We should never discount and pass over those relationships and just think, oh, that's unimportant to me. That's just my job. That's just what I do on Thursdays. Or even this, that's just what I do on Sundays is church. What we see as insignificant or just another detail may be the instrument or the avenue that God is using to continue building his church. And we should never discount what God sees as important and what we may see as just kind of trivial. Secondly, don't be discouraged if you find yourself there with the seemingly unproductive or unimportant role you play in God's plan. Well, Pastor, I'm not a preacher. Pastor, I'm not a missionary. Pastor, I just work at NextEar. I just work at Dow. I'm just a student out here studying basket weaving. Even you're important. No. But we know that God has a big plan with many people playing many parts in his plan. And we should have confidence, just as God gave confidence to Paul. We should have confidence that God is the one who grows the church in all settings. He does not just grow it here on Sunday morning with the preacher preaching the gospel or preaching the Bible. It happens with his people out there in the real world with hands and feet engaging people, as Pastor Mark alluded to last week, that he'll never meet, that I'll never meet. You have family members and you have people who you engage with and you have good news that most likely will never be shared from the pulpit to them unless you go out there and share it with them. So he has many parts with many people playing many parts in his plan, and we should have confidence that God grows it in all settings, and it's not through our strength and our effort. It's not me or Paul or Apollos or you on your own doing it. God is the one that's doing it. He's putting you in situations with people that's what it's all about. That's not taken for granted that was supposed to be the way it was supposed to be. You're where you're supposed to be right now, ultimately. Big picture, once again, God doing his plan. God is doing something great. It's unbelievable if we know the details. We have the luxury, if you want to say it, look at that way. We don't know the end. We know ultimately the end, but we don't know what tomorrow holds or the next day holds, and that's by design, and that's okay. We just know that God did tell us, we may not believe that God's going to do it. And ultimately, once again, we don't want to discount and take for granted the fact that we are all gathered here together on Center Road on Sunday morning, and it's not just for Sunday morning. This isn't something to be taken for granted. And it's not a reason to be discouraged or cast myself off as I'm unimportant or I don't play a significant role. We don't play that game. So that's Acts 18. We know that Paul stayed there a year and a half, and we know that, you know, these characters came up in real place, in real time, in real space, and that God used a lay couple from northern Turkey and bounced them around the Mediterranean, and they converged and met Paul in Corinth. We know that he used Apollos, an Egyptian preacher convert, to kind of come and water the gospel that was planted by Paul, and we know that he used Gallio, a pagan, a staunch pagan, to free up his minister to preach the gospel for 10 years after he left his presence. And that man died a pagan. History tells us that. So he didn't come to belief. So there are people in God's plan of all stripes. And there's a lot of stripes here represented today. And I think we all would be a benefit if we go and be like, yeah, God, thank you for the opportunity you've given me to serve in my way. And I just pray, and we will pray to that end, that God would help us to proclaim his name in all settings, wherever we find ourselves. And that'd be good application as we leave here. Let's pray, and then a few announcements, and then we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to gather. I thank you for the opportunity to preach this morning. It is a humbling experience. And I just trust that your word is powerful, and I trust that your word will cut to the heart and apply itself in ways that even I haven't seen in the slides today. Your gospel is good news, and your work that you're doing is great, and we are humbled and thankful for the opportunity to play a part in your grand plan. You're a good God that has loved unlovely people, and for that we apologize and ask forgiveness, but we just ask that you would continue to mold us, that you would bind us as members and attenders here at Emmanuel, that we wouldn't just be passerbys on Sunday morning, but that we would be like, yeah, no, we're connected, we're part of the family of Christ and his church. We thank you again for the opportunity to look to your word and just ask that as we go from here that you would plant your word deep in us and that you would cause it to grow up, that we would have affections that are desirous to know you more, and that we would our faith would be built stronger because of your word and the relationships you've given us. Thank you again, and we just ask that you would continue to transform us in the likeness of your Son. In Jesus' name, amen.